was born in Finland January 10th, 1883. She married the late Gus Utila in Butte, Montana on November 9th, 1907. Gus headed for the gold fields at Iditarod in March of 1913. Ina left Seattle in June 1913 to join Gus. She boarded the steamer Seattle, headed for Nome. From there, she transferred to other boats, finally arriving at Iditarod 25 days later. Ina's first home was located in a corner of a blacksmith shop. She and Gus proceeded to section it off, install a floor, and build furniture. Ina mentioned sleeping on her face while they were in the blacksmith shop due to portions of the moss sod roof falling down both day and night. The Utilas were in the wood freighting business from 1914 to 1917. They moved to Ophir Creek in 37 and mined there 27 seasons before retiring. Ina has been a guest of the Pioneer's home since 1967. Next on our list is our King Regent, Einar Red Anderson. Red left his homeland, Sweden, at the age of 17 and headed for the gold fields of the Yukon and Alaska. He came via the White Pass and Yukon Railroad, drifted down the Yukon, spent a short time in Circle and Dawson, and proceeded from there on foot, arriving in Fairbanks May 15, 1910. Shortly after his arrival, he got a job working for Roughlock Johnson on 19 Below Goldstream. Later, Red headed for Manly and went to work for Johnson and Morrison at the mouth of Boston Pup. He mined extensively in the Manly area for many years. He then went to Rampart, got married, and mined Little Minook and Quail Creeks. Red and his wife, Catherine, have three children and six grandchildren. They moved back to Fairbanks in 1942 and have been here continuously since then. We've got royalty from Anchorage here with us today. Our Anchorage Queen Regent, Nellie Johansson. Nellie first came to Alaska in June 1934, arriving in Talkeetna at that time. She and her husband started in the mining game with the Alaska Exploration Mining Company and the Peters Creek Mining Company at Petersville. She has since then been located at Ophir, McGrath, and Anchorage. Thanks for joining us today, Nellie. Our King Regent from Anchorage is Emmett Cavanaugh. Emmett was born in Nome, March 9, 1911. He and his family moved to Sunrise 3 years later and then to Anchorage. He also lived in Nenana and Seward for a short time. He joined Igloo No. 15 in 1952. Thanks for joining us, Emmett. Next, we'd like to present the president of Auxiliary No. 8, Hazel Hall, with a bouquet. Hazel? We have a number of officers from the Grand Igloo with us today. I'd like to introduce past Grand President Adolph Stock. Next, I'd like to introduce Vera Siders, Grand Recorder. And Bill Schaefer, Grand Trustee. I'm Bob Huffman, and believe it or not, Grand Chaplain. Now, I'd like to introduce a group of truly grand ladies, the Pioneer Women of Alaska. Membership in this organization is qualified for those women that arrived in the Alaska or Yukon watersheds prior to January 1, 1908. First on our list is Mildred Nerland, President, who I'm sorry was unable to attend today. Next is Adriana Coyle, treasurer, Dawson 1900, and Fairbanks 1907. Next is Mrs. Clara Rust, Fairbanks, 1907. Amanda Hansen, Chena, 1907. Dorothy Loftus, Fairbanks, 1907. I don't believe Agnes Thomas was able to join us today. He was Douglas, 1902. Agnes is at the Pioneer's home. Another one listed for membership is Charlotte Cuban. I understand she's in town, but I don't believe she was able to attend today. Thank you. We'd like to give special recognition to an old-time pioneer, Bobby Sheldon, with us today, who just recently celebrated his 91st birthday. We'd like to present Bobby with a boutonniere. Bobby was president of Igloo No. 4 in 1955. Bobby? Our theme this year honors the riverboat men, those that truly opened up the wilderness beyond foot traffic and dog team capabilities via the Alaska and Yukon water highways. These water highways were available and used before the advent of motor cars and railroads. Today they remain a vital, viable link in our state's transportation network. Last week, Frank Young, I call him our pioneer historian emeritus, related the following information relative to our riverboat transportation theme. Frank has personal recall of many of the following riverboats, captains, and events. And I'll read them off for you. The Yukon, captained by Jack Green. The Florence S., Captain Smythe. The Tanana, Captain Gray. The Reliance, Captain George Green. This one made the longest run of record up the Tanana during the Shoshana Stampede. The Newcomb by Captain Newcomb. Lavelle Young, Captain Adams, who transported Barnett to Fairbanks in 1902. The Delta, Discovery, and Alice of the NC Company. The Minneapolis, a freighter. The Isabel, Captain Barnett. Ucana, Captain George Black. The Bertha, Captain George Moody. The Lottie Talbot, Captain Bill Hunter. This one burned and sank in 1906 above the present Cushman Street Bridge. The Sarah, Susie, Hannah, and Julie B., double stack packets of the NAT&T Company. The steamer Tana, Captain Longley. This one used to make an annual kids' picnic run from Chena, and finally made the trip from Fairbanks to Bethel, the only riverboat of record to make that trip. Art Peterson, son-in-law of George Black, and Captain Alan Brown, we're sorry they weren't able to attend today. They're old-time riverboat men, still, of course, in business out of Nenana. Vince James, another pioneer riverboat man, now at Eagle. Our featured speaker followed in the footsteps of these men, worked with some of them and many like them. Jim is a fellow pioneer, born in Wrangell, May 16, 1920. Charlie Binkley, his father, was a riverboat captain on the upper Yukon and rivers of British Columbia, having come to Alaska in 1898 from Indiana, where he was a pilot on the Ohio River. Jim, then, is a traditional descendant of all of the old-time riverboat captains we named earlier in the program. He is presently an active sternwheeler riverboat captain today. He's ably assisted by his wife, Mary, and their children. It is with great pleasure that I introduce our featured speaker, Captain Jim Binkley.
Thank you, Bob. You know, I'm truly proud to be a pioneer and truly pleased to be chosen to talk to you today about riverboating. I'm not sure that I'm the best representative of that industry, but certainly an enthusiastic one. I suppose it all began back in the days when the Russians were coming up the lower rivers, penetrating into the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, when Peter the Great decided to make the eastward movement, and Alaska was acquired by Russia in 1741. The coastal areas were settled, and people on our boat find it a great surprise when I tell them that Sitka, Alaska, had a population of 1,000 before San Francisco had a population of 100. So our history dates way back. With the acquisition of Alaska by the United States, it was still a frontier country and little known by the people of the lower 48. The westward movement of the United States was a cross-grained movement from Alaska because Alaska was moving to the eastward. The Russians gave way to the prospectors who were no longer interested in fur, but after the valuable commodity, the gold, to found along the Pacific coast in southeastern Alaska, then up in the interior. Well, you know, so many of these people whose names have been enumerated here today were fascinating personalities. I had the distinct honor, privilege, and pleasure of serving with several of them. And I might mention before I get moving here that I think this is the fourth time in 30 years that I've been out of the city limits of Fairbanks in the summertime. I should say away from the river. I had to raise my own riverboat captains to do it. Our three sons are now all licensed captains, and our youngest son, John, has quite a distinction. He's the youngest licensed stern wheel riverboat captain under the American flag. Took me 19 years to get my first day off. And what did I do on my first day off? I followed the boat down the river in an outboard. You know, I had the pleasure of working with Captain Charlie Adams, who brought Barnett into the country on the Lavelle Young. And little did I realize in the days that I was working with him that here was a great part of Alaska's true history. I heard a lot of stories from Charlie. I looked up to him as a hero because he was a magnificent riverboat man. He had been a gold miner. He came from Dawson. He had made his money in Dawson. He moved to Nome. He needed riverboats to work with. He wasn't able to get the kind that he wanted. So he acquired his own, and he became a licensed riverboat captain in his own right, and a very excellent one. I can almost remember word for word as he told me about sitting on the beach at St. Michael with Barnett, discussing the possibility of coming up the Tanana River. He related to me some of the problems that they encountered in coming up in those days and the fact that they were the very first one to come this far. Charlie, in latter days, was the skipper of the steamer Nenana, and I served with him on the steamer Barry Kay during the years of World War II. Now, Charlie always dressed up. He had on a blue serge suit, a white shirt and a necktie, and a black Stetson hat. I think when I worked with him, he was up in his 80s, and at that time, the proprietor of the shipyard at Nenana, Haggard Olson, was about the same age. Now, getting the ships ready for a season is a tremendous job, and looking into a big season is also a tremendous job. Skipper of the boat has terrific responsibilities, spends long hours at it, and it's extremely hard work. I wondered about the welfare of Charlie, but he was pretty sturdy. They were about to launch the Barry Kay, and Charlie came to me and said, "Kid, let's go down and watch him launch the boat." Talked in a kind of a high, squeaky voice, and I said, "Okay, Cap, let's go." So we walked down to the shipyard, and Haggard Olson, same age as Charlie, had his overalls on, and they were letting the barricade down onto the butterboards prior to launching. And Charlie looked at this fella working around there, and I thought to myself, "Well, Charlie, you're standing into a terrific season." I didn't say this to him, but it went through my mind. "I don't know how you're going to handle it." And he looked at me, and he said to me, "Hey, kid, look at that old fool, Haggard Olson. He don't know when to quit, does he?" Charlie was not much of a storyteller, but I can remember a couple that he related to me. And one was an interesting one. It had a little religious connotation. Charlie told me in the wheelhouse on a long upstream journey from Galena on the old steamer Barry Kay that Moses on the mountaintop had received a message from God. And he took his scroll and came down into the desert. And on the way, he encountered a group of Syrians. And he suggested to them that they accept a commandment. And one of the Syrians said, "A commandment? What commandment?" He said, "Thou shalt not kill." And the Syrian said, "Well, we can't do that. That's our way of life." So Moses was a little discouraged, and he moved on. And he encountered an Arab. And he said to the Arab, "We'd like you to take one of our commandments." And the Arab said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Thou shalt not steal." said, well, we can't do that. That's our way of life. Then he came upon a wandering band of Jewish merchants. And he said to the leader, we'd like you to take some of our commandments. And the Jewish merchant said, how much are they? And he replied, there's no charge. Fine, I'll take 10. Charlie's brand of humor. He was a terrific river man. I learned as much from him as I did from my good friend, Captain George Black, for whom I worked for so many years. He, too, was a tremendous river man, a great guy, and he really knew his business. I recall vividly his sleeping in the wheelhouse whenever I was on duty. I'm not sure just why he did that. We were coming upstream between Minto and Nenana early one morning, and I had a great habit of taking shortcuts when we were carrying big loads. So we had the steamer idler at this particular time, and I was taking a direct shortcut, moving up a side slough, and I was making absolutely no time whatsoever. George was in the bed just behind the wheel, sound asleep, in his long underwear, and he somehow sensed that I wasn't making any time. So he climbed up out of bed, and he looked at me, and his white hair was standing on it, and his steely blue eyes were penetrating into mine. He said, kid, you're not making any time here at all. Get out of the way. So he moved over, put the boat right up against the bank, inched it up a little bit, moved me back into the stream again. He said, here, now go back to work. And he climbed back into bed and went sound asleep. How he ever knew I wasn't making time, I'll never know. These guys had a sensitivity for this sort of thing. I remember a story that was told to me by the late Captain Sid Barrington, with whom my dad served, worked years ago, worked as a partner with him, telling me about bringing a steamboat down through Miles Canyon, up above Whitehorse. Terrific feat to bring a steamboat down through that wild, wild pile of water, through those vertical rocks on each side. Almost an impossible thing. They had a passenger aboard who was a dignitary from England, a stockholder in the White Pass and Yukon route who owned this boat. In order to get the boat down through the rapids, they felt that they should tie bales of hay around the outside. Then if they banged into the rocks, the hay bales would split open and protect the boat. So they did this, and the gentleman from England, who was properly attired, was watching these preparations and wanted to know why they were tying the hay on there. When they described to him what was going to happen, he wasn't sure he wanted to make the journey. At any rate, before they reached Miles Canyon, he repaired to his stateroom with a bottle of booze to console himself, and my uncle and Sid were passing this story along to me, and they said they went down through the Miles Canyon, sure enough, to hit the walls a couple of times, split open the bales of hay, and there was hay all over the river, clear down through Whitehorse Rapids. And as they came through the rapids and got close to Whitehorse, the Englishman came out of his stateroom with a little satchel in his hand, and he said to Sid, pardon me, Captain, but can you direct me to the nearest lifeboat? And I said, well, that's an interesting story, but what was so funny about that? He said, well, all he had on was his derby hat. The steamer Nenana, reposing now at the Alaskaland area, certainly is our tie, our immediate steam tie with the past. I think it's a wonderful thing that that steamboat has been saved. I think it's a great thing that we have a place like Alaskaland, where we can have some of our history, where we have our pioneers who still remember the beginnings of Fairbanks, who can identify these things for us. There's something that does upset me about that particular spot, however, and that's the name that it has. I think that it should be called the Pioneer Park, and I think the people of Fairbanks should press for that just as hard as they can. To me, Alaskaland doesn't fit. Pioneer Park does. That's our heritage. You know, in recent times, we have a lot of fun out on the river entertaining our guests from out of town, and we try to share with them some of the things that we have seen and done in the past. And I relate some of the stories that I've heard from some of the skippers. Down near the town of Old China, there still rests up on the hillside the remains of the old stamp mill. And Charlie Adams was telling me a story about the old stamp mill. I'm not sure about the authenticity of this story. But at any rate, he indicated to me that during Prohibition days, the supply of booze that came into Fairbanks came from Canada. And in the wintertime, this dried up occasionally. So one of the fellows had taken up residence in the old stamp mill down at the old town of China. And he had established a little still there. So during the winter, their supply was cut off. They had a miners' meeting for this terrible occurrence that had happened and decided to send a dog musher down to Old China to see if they could get some bootleg hooch from the fellow who had set up in the in the stamp mill. So the dog musher took off. Charlie said he was a friend of the bootlegger, and he came down and tied his dogs up to the corner of the bootlegger's cabin. And the bootlegger came out with a jug of booze in his hand, and they uncorked the jug and had a big pull. And the bootlegger said to his dog musher friend, how do you like this new batch of whiskey I just made? And the dog musher, when he could get his eyes uncrossed, said, man, that's the best batch you ever made, but do me a favor, will you? Stick that cork back in the jug. Them fumes is killing my dogs. During part of World War II, I was sent to Eagle to come down on the steamer Klondike. with a group of men who were the very deans of riverboating in Alaska, friends of my dad's. And Captain Charlie Coghlan was the skipper of the steamer Klondike at that time, and it was a great thrill for me to go aboard. I was sent there by the Army as a pilot. They needed me like they needed another barge load of freight, which they couldn't handle anyway. The two pilots, they're old friends of my father's too, Guy Street and Emil Forrest, and they were absolute masters. So since I was assigned as pilot, I thought I'd better report to the wheelhouse. Here I am, 23 years old. These fellows have been at it all their lives, almost ready to retire. They had 1,200 tons of cargo on three barges. The steamer Klondike is approximately the same size as the steamer Nenana, so it was a big operation. So I importantly came to the wheelhouse to announce my presence, and Charlie Coghlan greeted me and had me sit beside him on the high bench. And during our trip between Circle, or Eagle and Circle, I made several trips down to the galley to bring coffee to the boys, and they let me steer in one stretch where the river was about 18 miles long and 5 miles wide. And on our way down, we had any number of very difficult times, and these very skillful people handled it with great authority. Captain Coghlan, of course, was well up in years, kind of portly gentleman, full of stories, and he sat there on the high bench behind the pilots and watched them work all the way down to Circle City. As you come up to Circle, it's a very difficult turnaround with a big load. And, of course, people would come down and flock the riverbank to watch the arrival of the steamboats. Well, as we came in, Guy Street was steering the boat, and I couldn't possibly figure how he could get that big load turned around. It just seemed impossible. Water's very swift, channel very narrow. But Guy, being the master pilot that he was, planted one barge on a sandbar, backed the boat down easy and let the current catch his turn, and twisted us around, and then with great power he pulled that barge off the sandbar while we were backing. Well, this is a beautiful maneuver. He swung around, and Guy was pretty satisfied with himself. And, of course, the captain is the final authority. And the fellow who is steering the boat when you come into town is the big hero. So just as we had turned around, now, Coghlan had been sitting on the bench beside me all the way down from Eagle, hadn't moved a muscle, hadn't touched the wheel. And we got turned around and straightened out, and 100 feet from the bank, he got up, smoothed out his coat, and he said, "Okay, Street, sit down. I'll take over now." This is the way it occurs on our boat. The kids do all the work, and I take all the glory. I might say that Mary does 50% of the work, too. My function in the wheelhouse anymore is to make conversation, blow the whistle, and wind the clock. But it's been great fun to try to perpetuate steamboating up here, and I think it's a great thing that the pioneers are honoring those people who participated in the development of our country by bringing their stern riverboats into the country, pushing tremendous loads, taking unbelievable risks under the most difficult of conditions. I join you in saluting the riverboat men of the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to request our President, Bruce Thomas, place a wreath in front of the monument in remembrance of Discovery Day. Thank you, President Bruce. The Alaska flag song is a beautiful piece of music. Few singers can really do it justice. However, we have one of those few here today, Robin Busby McFetridge, the Alaska flag song.
The gold of the earth.
Thank you, Robin. That was beautiful. I would like to ask Reverend Gene Stratmeyer to please pronounce the benediction. Reverend Stratmeyer.
Shall we rise for the benediction? And now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God the Father and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us now and forevermore. Amen.
Thank you, Reverend Stratmeyer. Before we close, a few announcements and comments. Well, first, we have a lot of visiting pioneers up here for this occasion. And I'd like to ask you at this time to hold your hand up, holler out your names, so that others can get together with you right after the ceremony. Now, starting on this end, we've got some old-timers just up here for the occasion, and we haven't had a chance to see you. Identify yourself, please, starting right here. Yes, sir.
George Coughlin.
George, thank you. Any others? Dorothy King. There she is. I can see her. Any others?
Laura Carr.
Laura Carr.
You're not a pioneer. You live here.
I am.
You live here.
Any others?
I belong to them.
You live here.
Savannah and Robert Willman. Audrey Loftus. Ted Loftus. Any others? Art? There's Art Loftus.
Mrs. Art Loftus.
Oh, yes, I was already introduced.
Any others?
Yeah, Clara.
Mr. Turnbull and who?
Clara Wooden.
Esther Turnbull and Clara Wooden.
Harry Hughes.
Harry Hughes. Annabeth Hanlon. Alma Despo.
Oh. And Sylvia Pratt.
Sylvia Pratt.
Oh,
yeah.
Myrtle Adler.
Myrtle Ander.
Adler.
Adler, pardon me, Myrtle Adler. Okay, I'd like to extend my personal thanks to Susie and Diane Yurkovich, our flower girls, Joe Abel, working very hard to set this up. Frank Young, Hugh Dugan, Gordy Mitchell, Ed Patton, Jack Murphy, Betsy Sharp, Adolph Stock, Reverend Stratmeyer, Charlie Bagley for cleaning up the grounds, Bob Hammy, PA, Robin McFetridge for a beautiful Alaska flag rendition, Captain Jim Binkley, of course, Lloyd Pike, Harry Hughes, Ed Herring. Is Earl Beislein here? Earl, we'd like to present you with a boutonniere. Earl recently retired as MC after 10 years of Pedro rededications. He deserves a special thanks from us for his years of fine service and a round of applause and a boutonniere. We'll pin you after the ceremony, Earl. Coffee and donuts are on the house. Compliments of Auxiliary Number 8, Betsy Sharp and crew. I thank you. It's been my pleasure.
It's been a long time, hasn't it?
It has been. I'm so glad to see you up in the bar.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm coming along real well.
Yeah. Do you know
Katrine? No, I don't. The name is very familiar. Katrine's used to mine down in Country. Maybe you know Gus.
Gus, huh? I knew him.
I was in Barney.
Now,
I was the year down there.
I knew Mr. Utilla, the older one. And
Charlie was his brother.
Yeah.
And then Eugene Utilla was Charlie's boy, and Roy Utilla.
And Roy and Eugene, and I've often told about them.
Yeah.
You know, they were, when I knew them, were young kids, and so the neighbors, some of the kids, they got to, they name of Utillon, so they got to call him Utillon. Finally, it got into useless. They called it one, and so then the other one, then they slapped them for worthless, so it was worthless.
Tell us your name for the benefit of my mic here.
George P. Coughlin, C-O-U-G-H-L-I-N.
And you, this is for the University Archives. I just have been making some things.
Oh, I used to be a very good friend of
And you came in 1926.
I came here in 1926, yeah. But Otto Geist, I was a very good friend of Otto Geist, you know, who did a lot of paleontologist work.
What did you do, Mr. Coughlin?
Well, I was in charge of a unit out here at the FE company.
Oh, were you?
Fish Creek. I was at Chattanooga, and then a little El Dorado, and then a Fish Creek. So then I left Alaska the night before Pearl Harbor.
Is that?
We sailed out of Seward. My wife was living then. And we sailed out of Seward, Alaska on December 6th at midnight, 1941. And, of course, the next day I had three children, and we were on the boat going down. And so when World War ended, World War First ended, then a gold went on the bum, you know. And so I assumed that the same thing was going to happen in World War II. So then I transferred outside, and
But you worked up at Fish Creek?
Yes.
Well, what did you do there?
I was in charge of the Fish Creek mining, hydraulicking.
The hydraulicking?
Well, we had the strip, you see. It was strip mining and then point thawing and then dredging.
I see.
It was all three operations, but each was a kind of a unit in itself.
How many people lived there at Fish Creek during that time?
Well, we had a camp there that had probably 100, you know, the men working. There weren't many people, many residents. My wife was there. And then I had, in fact, the matter is I had a youngster born while we were out at Fish Creek. And I had six youngsters. I had three that were born in Alaska and three after we got out of Alaska. And so, of course, there was another thing, too. At that time, the university hadn't developed to where it was now. And so we were rather interested in, and since we were way out in the creeks like that, that we had them where they could go to school and be at home. And so my six youngsters, there are five girls and a boy, and they all have graduated from the universities out there, and they have. I had one or two in a university for 17 straight years, and so there's three of them have master degrees, and two of them are certified accountants. And
tell me, how did you you began your operations on about May? Did you April? May?
Usually about May. Well, it depended. Now the dredges, they were froze in, and they had to get the ice out of the ponds, and they got the ice out of the ponds in about the latter end of March. They usually start about the 20th of March, and then they would use steam thawing rigs to thaw up the ice in big blocks, and then with cables they would hoist them out of the pond and loosen up the pond so that the dredge could start to swing. And then after they got the pond cleared, they went ahead and they had already thawed the ground, the gravel beneath the surface, and so it was ready to dig. And they could.
You want to go and visit with friends. I know I won't keep you any longer.
Well, this has been very interesting and kind of flattering, too, because.
Well, it's most interesting to talk with you, Mr. Crawford. And where are you staying while you're here?
I'm staying at the Chena View Hotel.
Are you? Well, maybe we could get together again
and
go into it further.
Visits, and I heard that there had been a tape made by who had been a man working with the university, and so we were out at the university one time when I was out here. I wanted to get a hold of it, but they couldn't find it.
Oh, really? Well, I'm familiar with some of the work that's been done, but I don't.
But I was quite interested. You gave me a tape on placer mining and, you know, modern methods of placer mining, and at least there was a piece in the Alaska Weekly about it. And so I thought, well, next time I go to Fairbanks, I'll go out and check up. We went out, and I couldn't find it. They didn't find it.
I'm going to, I think, put this back.